You're listening to the Texas Observer podcast from texasobserver.org. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara, and I am joined here in our Texas Observer fallout shelter by four wonderful individuals who have been covering the legislature since it began in the 83rd session. To my left is Liz Farmer and Olivia Messer. How's it going?
It's going well. Good.
They're unnecessarily nervous. I may or may not edit that out later. Also here with us is staff writer Patrick Michaels. Hey, Patrick.
Hi.
And Observer editor Dave Mann.
Hello.
And we were just discussing how the legislature seems to be less contentious than normal, and I think the man to explain that best is perhaps Dave Mann himself. Dave, why is it not so contentious this time around?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think that's an interesting question, and it's like the $64,000 question, or since we did the budget yesterday, maybe the $64 billion question. I don't know. I mean, I think that you would expect it to be very contentious because 2011 was so contentious and they cut so much money and they passed so much controversial stuff. You would expect that they would come back this time and those issues would still be kind of on the surface. And some of them are, but it just seems to be a whole lot less tense. And especially in the budget debate that they had yesterday in the House, I mean, it was like kumbaya over there, it seemed like. We were just saying 2 years ago, when I did the budget in 2011, you know, it took like 3 days, and I mean, it was...
Right, this was basically 12 hours.
Yeah, it was 12 hours. They did it all in a day. 267 pre-filed amendments. I don't know how many they actually got through. So many were pulled down. There was this like truce they called where, you know, the right-wing lawmakers said they weren't going to bring up their, you know, anti-abortion stuff, and the liberals wouldn't bring up the family planning cuts, and all that like really contentious stuff that we expected just got deep-sixed. And it just became kind of tame outside of a handful of little debates. So I thought that was... one, surprising, and two, kind of emblematic of most of what we see in this session. A lot of the contentious issues have either been negotiated or compromised on. I mean, there seems to be a real intent to keep things quiet and comfortable and non-controversial.
So one idea, you know, on this podcast, I think before the session started, we talked about how of three folks kind of running the state, Perry and Dewhurst were both kind of fresh off some losses.
Ass kickings?
Yeah, some fair-sized ass kickings. Mm-hmm. And that Joe Strauss was the one who, you know, as House Speaker, was kind of the strongest position of the three of them. So what if he's just, you know, got this power and feeling good about it and, you know, being very effective with you know, membership that, you know, he's got kind of, he's running the show.
Yeah, I buy that. I mean, he seems like he's driving the train. I mean, the House budget was so, like, and they brought so many people into it, you know? I mean, Sylvester Turner, Donna Howard, these kind of Democrats seem to have a lot of input in the budget. They got things that they wanted. And as a consequence of that, I think they really supported the budget. Even if it wasn't perfect, even if it didn't spend as much money on education as they would have liked, they felt like it was a pretty decent bill, and I think that's all because Jim Pitts and Strauss, you know, made this effort to bring people into the process. They're, you know, they're inclusive. And if that's the model Strauss likes, then he seems like he's driving the train. And maybe some of it is the election. I mean, maybe the election, not so much here in Texas, but nationally, maybe the Republicans are a little itchy about being so out there and so controversial on so many of these issues. I mean, the classic one is like Jane Nelson compromising on the drug testing welfare applicant bill. I mean, that was like, that's like your classic, I'm offering this bill so I can win an election somewhere, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, she came in and basically dealt with, I think, everybody's concerns, or a lot of the concerns that people had, you know, dialed it back, backtracked it, and made it a pretty reasonable bill to the point where, you know, the pretty liberal folks at Center for Public Policy Priorities were supporting it. So, you know, that's like another example where, you know, you've got Jay Nelson, who's a pretty strong conservative, and who in 2011 was out there talking about the rights of the taxpayers, you know, they're, you know, in the middle of the Senate budget debate, when they're cutting the hell out of all these programs, and people are talking about, well, look at all these people, you're cutting off programs, you know, what's going to happen to all these people? And her response to that was, well, what about the taxpayers? What's going to happen to the taxpayers? I mean, that was the line she was taking 2 years ago, and now in 2013, she seems to be taking a much different line. She's even talked about, you know, finding compromise on Medicaid expansion. So, outside of Perry and a few other people who are taking a pretty hard line, I think everybody's been getting along. Which is, I guess, good in some respects, but bad for reporters.
I love the measurable shock in your voice.
Yeah. So Olivia and Lizzie both wrote about places during the budget debate yesterday that there were, you know, some fights, at least. There was a little bit of conflict, and Medicaid expansion was one of those. That it seemed like the first decision they made in the House was kind of going along with this go along, get along thing. Opening the door at least a little bit to maybe looking at some kind of expansion, and then it changed.
But it seemed like that's what it was. But I mean, upon reflection, it seems like actually maybe they really just didn't understand what they were doing and weren't paying attention. I mean, that was the big thing that Morrison was saying when she was talking was, I didn't know what was happening. I was really distracted. We didn't understand what this amendment would have done, which a lot of people didn't believe, but even Burnham believed that. I mean, he really said, I think they were that bigoted. I think they're that, like, uninformed about what Medicaid expansion is, that they looked at the bill, they didn't know what it was, they voted for it, and then they regretted it immediately.
The thing I found weird is that We already have this amendment on Medicaid expansion that sounds kind of liberal, but when you look at the details, it's pretty conservative. I mean, like, this was the language that Tommy Williams had put in the Senate budget, and, you know, it says, I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it said, if the state expands Medicaid, they have to do these health savings accounts and, you know, a couple of other kind of conservative parameters. I guess it's kind of like the outline for a, like, Texas model conservative deal with the Obama administration on Medicaid expansion, which other states, you know, Florida and Arkansas and these other red states have done. I mean, it seemed like this wasn't out of left field. This wasn't some, like, liberal Medicaid expansion. It was a pretty conservative deal. So it was interesting that, like, they came back, they passed it, and then they came back and, like, changed their minds. They're like, wait a minute, what are we doing?
Do-over.
Yeah, well, do-over.
I mean, even though it was Lon Burnham's, it was mostly edited by Zerwas, and it was, like, taken from Tommy Williams' original plan. So it didn't really make sense that, I mean, one of the tweets that someone sent said they must have read all the news stories about it, and that must have been what changed their minds because they didn't realize what they had done. But even then, it wouldn't have done much because Medicaid wasn't going to, you know, pass whatever Perry could do to stop it. So it was sort of irrelevant. It was really just symbolic, if anything.
I also overheard someone saying that because it's in the Senate version, this House part didn't even matter, really, because after this process, they're going to have to reconcile that. But then there was someone else saying that if Perry decides he's not going to do something, he's not going to do something. So,
but that's the thing. I mean, yeah, it's in the Senate version. So when the House version of the budget and the Senate version goes to conference committee, you normally have to have something in one of the bills. So because it's in the Senate version, they still could do it. You know, that's a possibility. But the House, you know, clearly is against it. I think that's one reason Burnham pulled down the amendment, right? So they voted to reconsider it. Mm-hmm. It was like basically saying we want to have a do-over. Mm-hmm. That passed. So then the amendment comes back up, and then instead of actually re-debating it or re-voting on it, Burnham pulls it down. And he basically said that's because we didn't want to have a vote against it, basically saying something that would show, hey, the House is against this. Mm-hmm. We don't want it. So maybe that would give it some life in conference committee. If you haven't shown, okay, hey, the House is against this, they haven't had a vote yet, maybe it would give them more flexibility to bring it back up at some point.
Well, yeah, Burnham told me that he knew as soon as he had to go up to the mic to defend it against reconsideration that he was going to have to pull it down. It was within the same breath that they said reconsideration was voted, what, 93 to 54, the amendment has been withdrawn. There was no time lapse in between because Burnham had already said, just withdraw it, I'm done.
Yeah, and then there's the question of Perry, like, is he just want to veto that? How strong is he really against that?
Yeah.
He usually follows through on his veto threats. And, I mean, that's the other thing that happened this week was that press conference on Monday with Perry and Cruz and Dewhurst and Cornyn.
Big John.
Yeah, and, like, everybody who works at TPPF was there. That was, like, the language against Medicaid expansion at that thing was really strong. Like, there's metaphors everywhere. Medicaid expansion was like somebody offering a cigarette to a teenager to get the first puff, or the drug dealer offering the first dose for free to get somebody hooked, or fool's gold. That was the other analogy.
Creative one.
Yeah. I mean, basically, like, providing health insurance to poor people is akin to trying to get people hooked on addictive substances.
Uh-huh.
Which would be unhealthy.
Unhealthy substances.
So...
Yeah.
Moving on. Doesn't matter.
I was just thinking about how that we never saw that Medicaid expansion vote after all, and through the whole day, the school vouchers vote was kind of the only one that they did take a vote, and sort of everyone had to sort out where they stood on a controversial issue. I guess I'm just setting up myself here because I wrote that post on our site.
You did.
But that one was a lot of fun because it was there wasn't a whole lot of excitement over the various amendments. All the controversial stuff kind of got pulled down, but this one from Abel Herrero was a very short amendment and just said none of this money that we spend on public education is going to go to private schools. And we had like a 5 or 10 minute angry fight about school choice and vouchers and who sends their kids to private school and who should be allowed to. And it came down to not even being close that the House was against spending money on private school vouchers, which is kind of what the language had always been. You know, Strauss had said that there was not going to be any voucher support in the House. But just next week, there will be a Senate hearing on a bunch of voucher bills on that side that Dan Patrick has made such a big deal out of. So there's some clear division then between the two of them.
Do you think that... So they passed the amendment in the House version of the budget says you can't spend any public money on a voucher program or any kind of voucher program that would take money out of the public school.
Mm-hmm.
So does that basically say... you can't have vouchers this session? Or is it more the fact that the vote was so lopsided, it's clear that there just isn't the support in the House?
I think that's going to be important. I mean, to be honest, I don't know if the particular voucher bills that are in the Senate, because they deal with these business tax credits, that the money would never be in the foundation school program in the first place, if they would be covered by this amendment. But it sure was a signal about how the House felt about things. And it was, you know, Republican lawmakers and, you know, kind of the outer suburbs where there still aren't a lot of private schools, but, you know, they were kind of voted in on, you know, as hardline conservatives. Those are the ones who are really stuck in a tight spot and had to take some interesting votes and votes.
Yeah, were you surprised? I mean, we only got
43
votes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the last time, I remember votes that were kind of in the 60s and even some in the 70s. It's really close, 75, 70s, whatever. Some really close voucher votes in past sessions. I mean, they all lost. I mean, all those voucher proposals went down, but they were really close. And now we've got a chamber with 95 Republicans, and they only get 43 votes for a voucher, on a voucher thing. I mean, yeah. That, including Tom Craddock, voted against vouchers. I mean, it's, the former speaker who once almost pushed through a voucher bill a couple of times. I don't know. It just seems like, do you think, was that surprising?
You'd think that with just population shifting towards the cities and the suburbs, that you'd have more voucher support kind of swinging that way, that, you know, rural Republicans would be less, you know, less powerful compared to the suburban folks. And with, you know, so many folks sweeping in on Tea Party waves, saying that they're going to be the steadfast conservatives and defend school choice among other things, it sure seemed a little surprising.
Yeah. I also found it surprising, given, like, having spent more time in the Senate with following Senator Dan Patrick. I mean, he has pushed so hard in the Senate specifically. He's brought in Jeb Bush. He's, like, touted all that he's done for these voucher programs in Florida, and says it's, like, the civil rights issue of our time. And, like, the rhetoric he uses is just so ridiculous. And so it was interesting to see that sentiment didn't really follow over to the House chamber at all.
Well, and the temperature, I mean, the conversation on it was so tense, and there were so many people who spoke in favor of vouchers, that it just seemed surprising that the proportion must have just been off, because after a few people spoke, and people were dragging their children into it. You know, my children go to this school, and Bunny, my 2-year-old, does this, and it was just very, it was tense.
I mean, Dan Patrick does make a very big issue of it in the Senate, and I wonder, I didn't see anyone in the House yesterday kind of taking amping it up to quite the same level as he does, and sort of raising the stakes that much. And the folks who were doing that, like Scott Turner, freshman from Frisco, and the folks who weren't maybe as influential in the process, which is a nice segue to what you wrote about yesterday, which is another, you know, fight with, you know, started by a bunch of Tea Party type freshmen who wanted to shake up the budget process.
Yeah, I think what was interesting about that is it goes along with the idea that overall the whole budget process was kind of slow and not as exciting as some people had thought it would be, but part of that is because of one of the rules they adopted to set the total budget and not be able to make any cuts or add any to that total. So any changes they really wanted to make had to take money from one program and put it in another, which leads me to the Tea Party strategy, which was to cut money from these small programs for the most part, and put them into the Texas retirement system, which they said was because, you know, retired teachers, they deserve so much better, and they're facing this budget shortfall. And it was amazing, like, how much love for retired teachers was coming out at a time when it was obvious that wasn't really what they cared about.
It was clear that teachers were the big winners of the day. Retired teachers, everybody.
Yeah, people had never uttered a word about retired teachers suddenly, you know, had long been fighting for the rights of retired teachers. I mean, you can kind of understand where they're coming from. I mean, they've got, you mentioned the budget rule, so they have to just shift money. It's like shifting around deck chairs, basically, is what you have to do. And they hadn't had any influence, these, like, Tea Party freshmen, on the budget. And so they figure, well, we want to have some influence, so we're going to pick something we think is appealing. Hey, retired teachers, okay. And so we're going to cut everything we don't like and dump it into the retired teachers fund.
Some of the first grown-ups I ever met are retired teachers. what could be wrong with that?
Well, every time they pick someone, I mean, they picked, what, PhD programs in near El Paso, and Naomi Gonzalez got up and was like, wait a minute, that's my area, I don't appreciate that. And that's every time they got up, someone was like, nope, that's mine, I don't want you to touch it, thank you. And that was really how that went.
And I think what they discovered is that when you attack these areas of government or these spending areas, there's probably somebody on the House floor who either represents the geographical area that that's going to harm, or the, like, policy area it's going to harm. And so, yeah, you had people from a certain area saying, wait a minute, you're going to take away something in my district. Have you ever even been to my district? Mm-hmm. Or you had people who had been, you know, working on these issues for years saying, well, wait a minute, if you're so in favor of retired teachers, how come you haven't signed on to my bill doing something about the retired teacher's shortfall? And they didn't have any answers for that. And I think maybe they, you know, they got a little lesson there about how the House actually works, you know.
I mean, it really didn't take, you know, once the budget's written, you know, it seemed like it didn't take anyone any more than one person getting to that back microphone and having something bad to say about it, and the amendment would fail. It just nobody kind of wanted to rock the boat too much. I was thinking of Mary Gonzalez in El Paso had an amendment that was going to pull, I think, $4 million over 2 years for educational aides in the classroom, and it would take it from the $6 million a year that the state would put in for Teach for America. And then another Democrat, Rafael Anchia from Dallas, came up and just said, well, this is taking money away from Teach for America. Are you really sure you want to do that? And even, like, just asked her the question, didn't say that it was a bad idea, and that was enough to, you know, she pulled it and never came back. And the same thing, you know, with programs that like Jonathan Stickland, you know, one of the Tea Party freshmen, tried to bring up at the end of the night. And, you know, just a quick question from the back. It's like, are you sure you know what you're doing with this program? And then he pulled it really quietly.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting is most of the programs they were attacking really were these, like, a few $100,000. But there was actually one that was, like, the it was a research initiative, and it's a matching program. So if institutions raise so much money, you know, they'll match that and can do more research. And that was one of the Tea Party things that they wanted to do away with and put towards teacher retirement. And someone went up to the mic and was like, do you realize how beneficial this program is and what it's really done for our state and how it helps bring people to our state that we might not have otherwise? And that just shut it down. I mean, I think that was like $17 million worth too, which they were saying, if you look at teacher retirement, that's still chump change. But for this program, it means a lot.
Yeah, and that's like the video games too, right? The movie and television video game fund. Yeah. And the guy gets up there, and I can't remember whose amendment that was. And he was like, well, you know, I don't think government should be in the business of funding video games, which, you know, all right, yeah, that's a good talking point. But then, you know, the counter to that is, well, do you know how many jobs this fund creates and, like, how many people work in the video game industry, you know, in Austin alone? And you're actually harming the economy. And, yeah, again, it was like, that's something they probably hadn't, you know, thought about.
Oh, yeah.
There were a lot of rhetorical devices, like, do you know how many, et cetera? And the answer to that one, he was like, well, there are 45 video game companies, and they own 55 video games in Texas, and that's how many jobs. And they had the numbers on all of those things. And whoever was at the mic would be like, oh, I didn't realize. And they were pretty cavalier about that, actually.
That's what was interesting is, like, the conservative veterans in the House were really, like, schooling these freshman Tea Partiers. And it really came across as the Tea Partiers had just decided this is our strategy. But beyond that, as someone said, they really hadn't done their homework. So any of the questions about these programs, it's like they really seemed like freshmen. They didn't know what they were doing and how they were beneficial.
But that's where the politics is really interesting of it, too, because 2 years ago, I don't think a lot of those conservative Republicans would have had the courage to, like, stand up to those folks the way they did this week. I mean, 2 years ago, the Tea Party was really running the legislature, and Michael Quinn Sullivan and Empower Texans was, like, you know, basically the guy in charge. I mean, he was running the agenda, basically, of the legislature from the outside, and people were intimidated by him and afraid of him. And he had this tremendous power. And now, just 2 years later, you've got any number of Republicans that have stood up to the Tea Party folks, stood up to Michael Quinn Sullivan. You know, he's been kind of ranting on Twitter about all the people they're going to challenge in the primary. And it's kind of like, well, you can only make that threat so many times, and it doesn't seem to be having the impact anymore. I mean, how many, you mentioned it, conservative Republicans, Larry Phillips, Dan Branch, you know, went to the, you know, Harvey Hildebrand, went to the mic yesterday and were basically shooting down the Tea Party members. And Michael Quinn Sullivan and Peggy Venable are on Twitter threatening these folks, and it's kind of voices into the wind is what it seemed like. So I really think there's been a shift in dynamics. I mean, the influence of the Tea Party, and maybe this is one of the themes of the session, the influence of the Tea Party is clearly diminished.
There was a great, I stayed up to watch from home, I'll concede, but at the very end of the debate, which didn't even go that late, I'm just a lightweight. Steve Toth, one of the you know, Tea Party freshmen who was part of this whole swing, gave a speech on the budget debate at the very end, and closed it. You know, and he was you know very like deferential, and he thanked the veteran members for their grace, and it was just such a like conciliatory, like nice note to end the whole thing on, that even the ones who were supposed to be picking the big fight, you know, kind of came out, you know, shaking everyone's hand.
I was really surprised that none of the abortion or gay rights, I mean, Bill Zedler had that bill that was supposed to take all funding from public universities that had anything to do with gender or sexuality. And a lot of people just ripped them down before they even were brought up, which I thought, I didn't anticipate that.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of gets back to where we started, where, like, that was kind of the theme. Like, mm-hmm. It was, we're all going to get along and get this done quickly, and everybody kind of had this, like, mutual disarmament agreement, and then nobody seemed to want to be that person who was going to bring up the really offensive, contentious thing that was going to take up 2 hours of debate and, you know, probably get voted down anyway, which was statesmanlike, I guess.
It just seems strange to even file an amendment that's that contentious if you're going to pull it before it's discussed or considered.
But that's the thing. I don't think they had intentions of pulling it, and then it just kind of snowballed. Like, they had the agreement on the abortion stuff, and then it just kind of, all the really contentious stuff that they normally would spend 2 or 3 hours arguing over, and then it would just, to no end, just got pulled down. They were done that night. And it's like, we could be done today. Go home.
Doesn't that sound better?
Yeah.
It almost felt like especially the older members were like still reeling from last session, and we're like, guys, we've done this before. Let's just make it nice and pretty, put a bow on it, and send it on its way.
Well, it was an interesting progression too, because it was like, you know, possible Medicaid expansion endorsement, school vouchers, Tea Partiers get shut down, and up until Medicaid was pulled again, all of the Democrats were tweeting like, what is this? I don't even recognize this place. This is amazing.
Of course, I mean, having said all that, I mean, it's still, the budget still doesn't like put restore the money for school funding. So, I mean, I think that, you know, I think you can have a pretty good debate about the fact that I think the House version of the budget is way better than what happened 2 years ago. And clearly they restore funding for a lot of things, and they're putting $2.5 billion or $3 billion back into schools, which is great. Of course, they cut $5.4 billion last time, so we're not even close yet to getting back to where they were 2 years ago.
With a whole bunch more students.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, there's two sides to it. The one side is, this isn't good enough, and you're still way short of where you were 2 years ago, and we still haven't dug out of this hole. And the other side is, well, you kind of get out of the hole, it takes a few years to get out of that hole, and you're, you know, this is a good step in the right direction. And I think you can argue both sides, and we kind of saw that, or I saw that in 2005. 2003 session, we had all these cuts, and 2005 session, they kind of undid some of them. And then in 2007, they undid some more, and in 2009, they did it again, and then they went more cuts.
It's almost as if history repeats itself.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a sad story when the best thing that happens is that they don't cut additional things or take any more rights away.
Yeah.
Well, that was a sad note for a podcast that has been overly positive, which is not really normal for us, but I'll take it. I'd like to thank all of you for being here and for your leadership and grace. And we'll be back with another episode of the Texas Observer podcast when some interesting things start happening and we're not busy writing about them. Thank you for listening.